We're studying this evening in the 13th chapter of Nehemiah, which is the last chapter of this book. We hope that we'll be able to finish it this session, but we're not sure if we will or not. It's a rather long chapter, 31 verses. And it's just kind of a commentary on the last things that Nehemiah did to set in order the worship and function of the Jewish people after they had returned back to the land of Judea. In the first verse, on that day they read in the book of Moses in the audience of the people, and therein was found written that the Ammonite and the Moabite should not come into the congregation of God forever. And that's found over in Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 through 5. And the reason is given in verse 2, because they met not the children of Israel with bread and with water, but hired Balaam against them, that he should curse them, howbeit our God turned the curse into a blessing. Now, these two nations, Ammon and Moab, were actually kin to the Israelites. Ammon was the descendants of the son of Lot that he had by his youngest daughter. Moab was also the descendant of the son of Lot that he had by his eldest daughter. And so these nations are actually cousins. And since Lot was kin to Abraham, then they are actually also kin to Israel. And the reason that they were forbidden to come into the congregation was because they met not the children of Israel with bread and with water. That is, when they were preparing to go into the land of Canaan, when the Israelites were preparing to go in the land of Canaan, Moab and Ammon did not assist them, did not meet them with bread and water, but rather they tried to hinder them. Now, we keep coming back to this thing of hospitality over and over again. And the simplest form of hospitality is to simply give somebody bread and water when they're in need of food and sustenance. But rather than do that, rather than perform a simple hospitable act, they tried to undermine the people. They hired Balaam against them. Now, that he should curse them. Now, the story of Balaam is a long story. It's found over in Numbers, beginning in about the 22nd verse, and runs for several chapters and intermittent references to it. Balaam was quite possibly a true prophet of God. However, there's a lot of doubt as to the veracity of Balaam's office as a prophet. There is even doubt as to how true Balaam was a believer in the one God idea of religion. But he either was a true prophet or else he was a magician that the other nations looked up to as being a prophet that God chose to relate to and to give a message through. And so the nation of Moab had its leader Balak to approach Balaam along with the leaders of Ammon, and the Midianites were also involved, to place a curse on these people. Here was this giant nation of people, several hundred thousand, maybe millions of people sitting on the banks of the Jordan River, ready to go into the land of Canaan and having already overthrown some other nationalities and powers. And so they were afraid that they might just decide to turn on them. So they hired Balaam to curse them. Well, Balaam approached God about whether or not he could place a curse on them, and God refused to let him curse them. And Balaam was doing this not because he wanted to see these people cursed or necessarily because he thought they should be cursed. He was doing it for the greedy reward that he was going to get for performing this job of cursing them. And so He approached God on it, and God refused, and he approached God on three separate occasions and offered sacrifice, and each time God would give him the answer, no, and Balaam would try it from a different angle and camp on a different part around where the Israelites were, and each time God refused to let him do it. Well, in the course of all of this, he did say that the people were to be blessed rather than cursed, and Balaam said that since God had pronounced the blessing rather than a curse, he could not go against what God had done. So I think it's what he means when he says that he turned this curse into a blessing. Also, in the course of this, Balaam received some very interesting prophecies, and there are some that have deep insight into the plan of God and insight that you don't find in any other place except what Balaam received. And I don't know that Balaam understood them, but still they are recorded in the book of Numbers. And sometime we, if we have an occasion to study Numbers, we'd like to go into those more deeply. Balaam is a symbol of a person who has misused his prophetic office. He is compared by Peter to the false prophets of the day of Peter and the false prophets that would follow after Peter. He's also mentioned in the book of Revelation in that same derogatory sense. And the way Peter describes this is that the false prophets of his day were going after the way of Balaam and following after this same reward, the reward of unrighteousness or the reward of iniquity. Now, that is, they're being hired to try to pronounce a certain thing unto or upon a group of people, and it's not God's will, and they're able to see that it's not God's will, but because of the money involved, they want to keep on doing it. They keep trying every way to be able to do this. So because these Ammonites and Moabites had done this thing, then it was written in the book of the law of Moses that the Ammonite and the Moabite should not come into the congregation of God forever. Now here again is we wonder just to what extent this was to be carried. Should not come into the congregation of God forever. It probably means that they were not to be allowed to hold any kind of authoritative position in the congregation of God. I rather doubt that it means they could not become a proselyte. But as long as they remained an Ammonite, true to the god of Ammon or the god of Moab, then they could not hold any kind of an office or of influence or anything in this congregation. And the reason I'm saying this is because Ruth was a Moabite. She was a descendant of Moabites, and she then came into the lineage of the Lord, actually. But she was a proselyte. She was actually a convert to the true religion of the true God. So I think that probably has to be given some interpretation there. Now it came to pass, verse 3, when they had heard the law, that they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude. Now this is interesting what he says about the mixed multitude. It's probably the offspring and the wives of those nations that were like Moab and Ammon. And they separated from Israel all the mixed multitudes. We keep coming up with the same idea over and over again that God does forbid his people to be mixed and mingled with those round about who hold ungodly ways. And we're going to get into that even more detailed in this chapter. So when they read this in the law, they brought about this separation. Every time they come up with something in the law, they bring about a separation. Now remember the way that Nehemiah and Ezra started getting these people really back onto the right track of worshiping the true God is that they had a series of sessions in which they opened up the book of the law, and they read in it distinctly and caused the people to understand the reading. And when they started doing this, and the people started getting back to God, they started keeping the ways that God wanted them to keep. They kept the proper feast days. They reestablished the temple worship and all these things. And here they read this. And so this then was an incentive for them to carry out the edict to separate from Israel all the mixed multitude. And before this, Eliashib the priest, having the oversight of the chamber of the house of our God, was allied unto Tobiah. Now, this is interesting about Tobiah. Tobiah is called earlier in the book of Nehemiah, the slave. He probably had been a servant in the house of one of the Persian kings. And he now had some kind of an authorityship in the area of the Ammonites. He was an Ammonite. He was closely aligned to one that we learn whose name was Sanballat. And Sanballat was a Moabite. Sanballat was also the ruler of an area of Samaria. And he was one of the great enemies and opposers of the rebuilding of the wall by Nehemiah and his company. So these two were working close together, and it's strange that they are, one is an Ammonite and one was a Moabite. And we just read the edict about the Ammonite and Moabite should not come into the congregation of the Lord forever. But Tobiah, he had some close connections with Israel. His son had married a daughter of one of the families of the priests. So he had a close connection that way. And he himself had married a daughter of one of the Israelites, so that he was a son-in-law of one of the Israelites. So he had some close ties now with these Israelite people, these Jewish people, through marriage. Well, we're going to learn a little later that Nehemiah had to leave Jerusalem for a while. He was over there for 12 years, and he went back to Persia and stayed for about a year. Then he came back, and when he came back, this is the condition that he found. That this Eliashib, the priest, having the oversight of the house of the chamber of our God, was allied unto Tobiah. Now, another thing that's interesting is that Eliashib's grandson had married Sanballat's daughter. So he was tied in with Sanballat through marriage. Tobiah was tied into the priesthood through the marriage of his son, and he himself was tied into the Jewish people through his own marriage. So this intermarrying was a thing that God sure did forbid, and you can see what kind of problems it got him into. So the priest now, Eliashib, who was in charge of the chamber of the house of our God, that would be this large area of the temple that was set aside to lay the stores into. He had prepared for him, that he prepared for Tobiah, a great chamber, where aforetime they laid the meat offerings, the frankincense, and the vessels, and the tithes of the corn, the new wine, and the oil, which was commanded to be given to the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the offerings of the priests. So this great chamber that was set aside to lay these goods into, which were part of the tithes, he had taken that and misused it by giving it to Tobiah. Tobiah the Ammonite, who was living right there in a choice place in the house of God that is in the temple. And the priest let him do this. So then Nehemiah says in verse 6, "But in all this time was not I at Jerusalem." This is when he had to leave. We mentioned that earlier. "For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king, and after certain days obtained I leave of the king." And it's thought that he was over there about a year before he came back. So he was here for 12 years. He went back to Babylon, then he came back now. And when he came back, he found this situation. Tobiah, living in the temple, having been given this great chamber by Eliashib. Another interesting aside that we'd like to mention again is that this king Artaxerxes, who let him go to Babylon in the first place and who gave him the commission and who provided him the expenses to do this, he was a stepson of Esther. And Esther was quite possibly even still alive at this time, and there's a great chance that she had an influence on him to encourage him to provide for the return of Nehemiah to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls and to have the blessings and the support of the Persian government in so doing. So don't underestimate the position that Esther played in this. And I came to Jerusalem and understood of the evil that Eliashib did for Tobiah in preparing him a chamber in the courts of the house of God, and it grieved me sore. Therefore I cast forth all the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber. Now there might have been many reasons and justifications for having done this. Tobiah was a great enemy, you know, of their rebuilding the wall. But Tobiah also was an Ammonite, and they just read in the law where the Ammonites were not to be able to come into the congregation of God forever. Well, here was one living there in the temple, being put up by one of the priests. So you see what strange alliances this intermarrying of the people creates. These people were intermarried in a lot of different directions, and it so lowered the thought and the feeling of the high morality of this priest that he took the things of God and completely misused them. He stopped taking in the tithes that were for the Levites and the singers, and he put Tobiah in that area, gave him that choice place to stay. I mean, there weren't too many people who could go live in the temple, you know. And it seemed that it didn't seem to bother him to do all this. And you can see how that his resistance was broken down by these family ties. But Nehemiah said, it grieved him sore, therefore I cast out all the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber. Then I commanded, and they cleansed the chambers, and thither brought I again the vessels of the house of God with the meat offering and the frankincense. And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, for the Levites and the singers that did the work were fled everyone to his field. Here the Levites and singers that were supposed to be provided for by this tithe and do a certain amount of work there that went with it, they had to flee the place and go out to the fields to make a living. So that part of God's work was completely neglected due to the sin of this Eliashib, the priest. Then contended I with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Now you remember when they had the great covenant in chapter 10, the very last of that chapter, the last thing they said was, and we will not forsake the house of our God. Well, here just a very short time later, Nehemiah gone about a year, short time later they had forsaken the house of God. The Levites and the singers were no longer even provided for. They had to go out and go to work in the fields, and a stranger was moved into the temple. And so Nehemiah asked the question, why is the house of God forsaken? We hear people talk about being positive and do not step on anybody's toes. Don't be meddling whenever you're trying to teach the things of God. Just say things that will be not offensive to anybody. Just be ultra nice and extra polite about every little thing. But there comes a time when those who are going to stand up for God's word, and that's all of us as Christians, there comes a time when we may have to cry out against something that's wrong. Maybe call it by name and point out that this is a violation of the command or the teaching of God's word. And Nehemiah certainly did this. He called the rulers, he contended with them, and he asked them, why is the house of God forsaken? Now you'd have to know that there wouldn't be a very good way to answer that question. That's kind of an embarrassing question. Obviously they were in the wrong, but Nehemiah asked them, why have you forsaken it? Causing them to provoke themselves to thought as to why had they done this? Really, were they that weak? Were they that unobedient, disobedient, and so on? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Then brought all Judea the tithe of the corn and the new wine and the oil into the treasuries. And I made treasures over the treasuries. And he names here in this verse four people that he named for that office. And he says in the last part of verse 13, For they were counted faithful, and their office was to distribute unto their brethren. Now, he set four people over this distribution of these tithes that were brought into this treasury. And the outstanding thing about these men is that they were counted faithful. That is, they had a reputation of being faithful. Nehemiah didn't set just anybody over this job. He didn't give somebody that was of questionable character or integrity or had a questionable faith this job, but he gave it to people who were counted faithful. One was called Shelmaniah the priest, and then Zadok the scribe, and of the Levites, Padiah, and next to them was Hanan. So these four people, and their office was to distribute unto their brethren. So Nehemiah was setting things back in order now. He was doing the things that were appropriate to getting this system of God back on the true track of honesty and integrity. Then he says in verse 14, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and wipe not out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for the offices thereof." He just simply asking God to remember him for his good deeds. Don't forget the things that I've done. And it might be another way of him having said, "Have mercy on me, God." I don't think that this is really intended the way that we might could twist it around and make Nehemiah think that he's patting himself on the back for being so good. But he's asking God to remember his good deeds. Verse 15, "In those days saw I in Judah some treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sheaves, and lading asses, and also wine, grapes, and figs, and all manner of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals." Now, this verse is just simply naming some of the things that Nehemiah saw the people doing on the Sabbath day. He noticed on the Sabbath day, which was to be a day of rest, a day dedicated to the service of God, he saw them going on about their everyday activities of work. Treading the grapes, loading the asses, bringing in the sheaves, and the wine, grapes, and figs, and so on. And there they were selling these things on the Sabbath. Direct violations of God's law. Now, it seems that man has always had this idea that he had to so press himself and so do things that he just didn't have time to do what God wanted him to do. He had to become involved so that he had to neglect the things of God. Now, you know, if God had a command that you were to keep the Sabbath day holy and not do any kind of work on that day, nor have any of your servants or any of your beasts of burden do work on that day, that then when you went out and deliberately did work, such as he named here, treading out the grapes and so on, that this was a direct violation of the principle of God. And so I think we're going to have to continually look at ourselves to be sure that we do not let the affairs of this life take on an importance in our lives that should not be there. God's way is first. And the time that we're to set aside for God should be a time that we do not neglect. Now, you know, we can get so busy that we never have time to study the Bible. We can get so busy that we never have time to pray. We can become so busy that we never have time to talk to anybody about the Bible. No time for this. We're so busy, so involved. Well, everybody's got the same number of hours in the day. And the principle of God has always been that time be taken to do the things of God. Now, I know that there are some occasions in which things arise that we don't have any control over, but that doesn't mean that we can't make time some way or another to do the things of God. In the days of Nehemiah, the time was the Sabbath day. They were not to do work on the Sabbath day. And as long as that law was in effect, it was a violation of God's law. Today, if we neglect God in any of those things that is necessary for us to do, if we neglect God for the purpose of caring about our daily activities of work and making a living, then we're doing the same thing that these people are doing here. We must not neglect God. Whatever we have to do to carry out our duties to God, we must carry out these duties to God. And he goes on in verse 16, there dwelt men of Tyre also therein. Now Tyre was a city, you know, way up on the coastline north of there. It was a fishing seaport area. And so these men of Tyre came down, which brought fish and all manner of ware, and sold on the Sabbath unto the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. They came and they sold on this day. They conducted business on this day. And we're going to find that there's just hardly any kind of a business or endeavor that you can be in that your cohorts are not going to want to do something at a time that'll keep you from worshiping God. I know in the business of practicing medicine, they're always setting up medical meetings on Sunday where you just got to go and just take the whole day off. You couldn't go to church if you wanted to and still go to this medical meeting. You just have to make a decision. I'm either going to do this or I'm going to do this. And just have to wipe it out. And it's real common to set up meetings like on Wednesday night when most people, even in the denominational world, have to go to church. They'll set up meetings on this night. The large entertainment industries, such as professional games like football, they're notorious for having their great games on Sunday, where there's no way you could go to that game and go to church the way some of them are arranged. And we have to make a decision. Are we going to do like they do? They're just like the people from Tyre. They got their wares all spread out ready to sell. Are we going to buy? Are we going to take our time? We're going to encourage them to keep doing this? Or what's our decision? And so our decision has to be many times. We just have to forego something. It's not necessary. We don't have to do it. It's by choice. And so we have to forego something sometimes if it becomes into a conflict with what God has commanded us to do. And so these men of Tyre came and they were selling to the children of Judah in Jerusalem. Now if nobody in Judah had bought these wares, the men of Tyre wouldn't have kept coming down there because it wouldn't have been very profitable to go and have nobody buying. But somebody was buying. And so Nehemiah was trying to put a stop to all this. And so, verse 17, then I continued with the nobles of Judah and said unto them, what evil thing is this that you do and profane the Sabbath day? Look what you're doing. You're profaning the Sabbath day. Now, today we don't have a day that we regard as the Sabbath day. In the New Testament, we're not commanded to keep the Sabbath day holy. But we do have certain commands and certain things to do that we cannot afford not to do. And especially for commercial endeavors. Did not your fathers thus, and did not our God bring all this evil upon us and upon this city? Yet you bring more wrath upon Israel by profaning the Sabbath. Our fathers did like this, he said, and this is what caused all this great calamity to happen to this nation. Now you do the same thing. And it came to pass that when the gates of Jerusalem began to be dark before the Sabbath, I commanded that the gates should be shut, and charged that they should not be opened till after the Sabbath, and some of my servants set I at the gate, that there should no burden be brought in on the Sabbath day. So what Nehemiah did here, he just arranged it so that whenever sundown came on Friday evening, the gates were shut, and they were locked, and he put some of his own personal guards there to see that they were not open, and that nothing could be brought in on the Sabbath day. He put a stop to the commercial traveling through those gates from sundown on Friday until the Sabbath day was over. So the merchants and sellers of all kind of ware lodged without Jerusalem once or twice. Well, the people, instead of coming inside the gates, they just parked outside the gates. They lodged without Jerusalem once or twice. You can see they weren't going to give up that easily. Then I testified against them and said unto them, why lodge ye about the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. From that day, from that time forth, they came no more on the Sabbath. So what Nehemiah told them was, if you keep doing this, I'm going to arrest you. I'm going to put a stop to it. I'm going to arrest you and put an end to this. And so after he made that threat, he said, from that time forth, they no more came on the Sabbath. And we'll find, you know, a lot of times if we just simply put our foot down and we say, I'm sorry, that's my time to go to church, or that's my time to go to Bible study, or that's my time to do this or that. I've already prearranged it and I'm not going to change my plans. I think that's more important than this other, that people back off and they have to understand one way or another. They have to understand, whether they like it or not. And so you're gonna have in your life a continual encounter with those who would want you to take their interest, the things that they want you to do, and give absolutely no regard for your service to God. They don't have any regard for your service to God. They're not serving God, and they can't understand why you'd want to do such a thing. They think they're doing you a favor, maybe, by getting you out of church. But you have to be firm and put your foot down and take a stand and say, this is the way it's going to be with me and with my household. Verse 22, and I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves and that they should come and keep the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. So he had the Levites then take over this job. They were to cleanse themselves, they were to keep the gates, and they were to sanctify the Sabbath day. Then he says, remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of thy mercy. So Nehemiah keeps asking God to remember these things that he's done to restore the worship and the keeping of the ways of God in Jerusalem. Now verse 23. In those days also saw I Jews that had married wives of Ashdod, of Ammon, and of Moab. We've already talked about Ammon and Moab and learned about their origins and what God said about them. But then he said Ashdod. Ashdod is a different city now. Ashdod is a city that's located on the very southern border of Palestine, right over about 3 miles from the seacoast, and it's between Gaza and Joppa. It was one of the five Philistine cities, and so these Jewish people had taken wives out of Ashdod, out of that city, and then wives of Ammon and Moab. In the New Testament, we have a reference made to Ashdod. The New Testament name is Azotus. When Philip had met the Ethiopian eunuch and talked to him in the chariot, and Philip had baptized the eunuch, and then the eunuch went on his way, and Philip was caught up and was found at Azotus. And Azotus is the modern or more modern city of the old Ashdod. Verse 24, and their children spake half in the speech of Ashdod, and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. That verse is a little hard to understand. Some of the commentators say that half of them spoke the language of the foreigners, and half of them spoke the Jewish language, because part of them had Jewish mothers and part of them had foreign mothers. But I think what he's saying here is there's three kinds of people: those from Ashdod, those from Ammon, and those from Moab. Half of them spoke Ashdod, and the rest of them would then have had to have spoken the language of either Ammon or Moab. And said they could not speak in the Jewish language, but according to the language of each people. So whichever mother happened to be their mother, whether an Ashdodite, an Ammonite, or a Moabite, that's the language that they spoke in. Now you can see what a deplorable situation this is. Here these people were in the nation. They were trying to carry on the work of God, and they couldn't even speak the language of the people. They were actually foreigners. Their education and all had to be in the direction of these other nations because they didn't speak the language. They couldn't read the Word of God. They couldn't really carry on. They were just like foreigners in this land. And I contended with them and cursed them, and smote certain of them, and plucked off their hair, and made them swear by God, saying, ye shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, or for yourselves. Now, the interesting thing here is that the Bible talks about their language. But what is probably even more important than that is that these heathen wives would teach them not more than just the language. They're going to teach them the ways of the other nations, the ways of the foreigners. Now, That same situation can certainly exist in the church today. If we have members of the church marrying those who are not members of the church, then those who are not members, if they have any influence at all in the family, they're going to be influencing them in a direction that's the wrong way. And sure, the children are going to speak English language because that's the language that's spoken in this country, but they may not speak the Christian language. They may not be educated in the ways of Christianity because there is a strong influence that's continually there in the home all the time, 24 hours a day, to draw them away from the influence of Christianity. And it's just like having half a chance at being a Christian instead of a full chance at being a Christian for these children. And it's also like having half a chance of not being a Christian. There's every reason to think there can be just as strong an influence away from the area of Christianity as there is in the direction of Christianity. So this is a lesson that we need to learn for ourselves today. We may have families in the church, and I realize there are some of these that seem to be almost unavoidable situations. They might have gotten married before they obeyed the gospel and so on, but it does not change the fact that those who are Christians should not marry out of the church, because when they do, they are getting into the same identical situation that these people are in that Nehemiah condemned. Now he said, I contended with them and cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair and made them swear by God, saying, ye shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, nor for yourself. So Nehemiah got really, really rough with them, and he didn't just play around about it. He was really, really into it. And this is a lesson that keeps coming up over and over and over in the people of God, how that their great sin was that they married women who were not obedient to God. Now, he makes a point of this in verse 26. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin. Even him did outlandish women cause to sin. In 1 Kings, I'd like to read a little bit here about Solomon. This is such a powerful lesson that I think we should not let it go by. 1 Kings 10, 23 and 24, I'd just like to read a statement about Solomon. So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom, and all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Now, he was a wise man and a rich man, and all the earth came to him to hear his wisdom. Such a wise man, you think, well, now I'm smart enough that if I marry this person, I'm going to keep this person from having that kind of influence on me in my household. I'm going to see to it that it doesn't happen in my case because I am so smart. I'm well-grounded in the Bible. I'm a staunch believer in God, and nothing's going to sway me. I'm going to marry this person, and it's not going to do this to me. Well, nobody was as wise as Solomon, and nobody was as rich as Solomon. He had all kinds of money. He could have spent all of his time sitting around studying about the things of God, I guess, if he wanted to, because he had the power, the wealth, and the wisdom to go with it. But we turn to the next chapter, the 11th chapter. But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidianites, and Hittites. Of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go in to them, neither shall they come in unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Maacah, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord as did David his father. Then did Solomon build an high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem, and for Moloch, the abomination of the children of Ammon. And likewise did he for all his strange wives, which burnt incense and sacrificed unto their gods. And he goes on and says, the Lord was angry with Solomon, and because of this he said the kingdom would be divided, that he would take it out of his reign, which he did do. He would let his son have one tribe. His son, Rehoboam, had the kingdom to the south, which was Judah, because of what Solomon did. So you see Solomon here, the great man of God, the one that God had done so much for, given all this wisdom and wealth, he built temples to idols. He turned his heart away after other gods because of these wives that he married. And of all these women, 700 wives, 300 concubines, we only have record of one child, one son, Rehoboam. And Rehoboam was so wicked that he then split the kingdom. He would not listen to the wisdom of the older men. And he let the nation then become a divided kingdom. Of all that marrying and all that so-called love, there wasn't anything good came out of it. Only evil. So that's what he's referring to here. Solomon, king of Israel, he sinned by these things. And here you come, you're doing the same thing. You think you can get away with it? You think God's pleased with it? You think he's going to ever be pleased with it? He is not satisfied with this situation. And he keeps making the point over and over and over again. It seems we can't let it go because it keeps coming up again. So it's our duty to teach our children the truth on these points. Shall then we hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God in marrying strange wives? Verse 28. And one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was son-in-law to Sanballat, the Horonite. Therefore I chased him from me. Now we talked about that a while ago, how that Sanballat had married one of the, daughter had married one of these priest sons, and so he was a priest. But we see here where that Nehemiah put him out of the priesthood. He chased him from him. He got rid of him because of the fact that he had married this strange woman. So it begins to conclude by saying, "Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and of the Levites. Thus cleansed I them from all strangers, and appointed the wards of the priests and the Levites, every one in his business. And for the wood offering, at times appointed, and for the first fruits, remember me, O my God, for my good." So here we have Nehemiah concluding this. The final act that he names here that is the outstanding one is that of casting this man out of the priesthood because he had married this daughter of Sanballat. And so we see how that God just could not tolerate this kind of activity, and something was done about it. So we conclude the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah, who was a cupbearer for the king of Persia, who had no doubt a great deal of influence with this king, who was allowed in the year 444 B.C. to come back over here to Jerusalem to rebuild the wall. He did do that in 52 days. He did it against the opposition of many obstacles, such as Sanballat and Tobiah and those nations round about. He did begin to teach the Word of God along with Ezra, read from it and explain it so that they could understand it. He did reestablish the temple worship, the priesthood, and all of the articles that went with it. And that wall that he rebuilt in 52 days, portions of it are still standing today. And you can go over there to Jerusalem and see some of that wall still there now. It was a good work, and it was accomplished because the people had a mind to work. They set about the job of doing it, and it wasn't easy. They had to work by day and guard it by night. They worked with one hand and held a sword in the other hand, so the Bible says.